hit record. We will not forget that again. Alright, so segmentation was what we did last time. Okay. So if you remember, we said segmentation is the compiler's view of a program or a process. It basically captures the structure that the compiler has in mind when it generates the code, which means that every address space has a code segment, a data segment, a heap segment, and so on. So that's how memory is laid out as per the compiler. Okay, so segmentation reflects that view of the address space. It basically assumes that each process has multiple segments, each segment can be a variable size, each segment has a certain semantic meaning associated with it, meaning it will contain code or data or some other thing. Okay. So the issue with segmentation is that because you are doing variable chunk allocation, you have external fragmentation. Okay, because each segment can be of arbitrary size, compiler's view is that each segment be stored contiguously. So you basically get back to fragmentation. Yes, question.
I was a little confused from last class. What was like the main advantage to using segmentation and paging at the same time?
Okay, what's the main advantage of using segmentation and paging at the same time? So it should be clear that why segmentation is necessary. This is how when the compiler generates code, it assumes an abstract memory layout, saying let's assume a certain virtual address space, we'll assume that this part belongs to code or this part contains code, here is where you store the stack, here is where you store the heap and so on. Okay? And it generates instructions assuming this memory layout, so it puts the variables on the stack or the heap and so on and so forth. Okay? Now that's how the compiler has generated code, so this is how you need to lay out the address space in memory. Okay? But if you do that, then you have the problem of external fragmentation. Now, the way you can get rid of external fragmentation is you always allocate memory in fixed size chunks. Okay, those chunks are called pages. So the way you can actually take the compiler's view of the address space and yet have a memory management scheme that does not have fragmentation is to have segments, but you page the segments. That's basically what it is. Okay, so your compiler can continue to generate code assuming that our address space has n segments, each segment has a purpose, certain purpose, and can generate addresses accordingly. But then when you lay it out, you don't have the issue of external fragmentation by paging individual segments. That's what basically you get. So that's the reason you want to combine them. So the compiler doesn't have to change how it generates code, and yet you can take that code and nicely put it in memory and not get into fragmentation issues. Right? So we did segmented paging. Now there are a lot of details I have left out here. So for segments, you need a segment table. When you do segmented paging, you have a segment table and a page table. So you need to figure out how to do the virtual to physical address translation. So you look up the segment table that has a pointer to the page table for the segment. Then you look up the page table that points you to a particular frame in memory. And then you look at the offset within that frame. Okay, so multiple levels of lookup. If you don't have hardware support, your memory accesses are going to be very slow, to factor of 3 slower. So you can use TLBs or registers to store page table or segment table entries, okay, to speed things up. Okay, so you need to know how the virtual to physical address translation works in segmented paging. Okay. So what we will do today is to now come to this memory management scheme called demand paging. Okay, fairly early on I said more sophisticated memory managers will not restrict the size of your process. Okay, or your size of your the process you run on your machines are not limited by the size of RAM. Okay, a single process can be bigger than the amount of RAM you have on your machine. Okay, and the way this is typically done is you need to store portions of, you only store portions of processes in RAM. The rest of the process is actually stored on disk and fetched on demand whenever it's needed. Okay? This scheme is referred to as demand-paged virtual memory. So we are going to look at, define it more carefully, look at how it works and so on. Okay? So until now we have implicitly assumed the entire address space of a process fits in memory. The address space does not need to be laid out contiguously as in paging or segmented paging, but we assume that all the pages are resident at all times. So now today we are going to relax this assumption. Okay, so what we will do is we will assume that the disk on your machine, okay, typically is much bigger than RAM. Okay, that's a reasonable assumption. You may have 2-4 gig of RAM, but you may have a 500 gig disk. So disks are much bigger. So what we will do is we will treat disk as if it was an extension of RAM. You can think of a disk as a very slow RAM. Okay, or we can treat it as if it was a very slow RAM. Okay. And what memory becomes essentially a cache of everything that is all the address processes that are actually stored on disk. Okay, so we will lay out the processes not in RAM but on disk and only take a subset of each process and put it in RAM. Okay, and then how to do this we will see. So what does this do? Okay, this allows us to give the illusion of essentially infinite RAM. Okay, you can start as many processes as you want. You are not typically limited by how much RAM you have. Typically you don't get a message from your OS saying sorry you used up your RAM. You just start processes. Performance might slow down as you start more and more processes, but you don't actually get limited by the amount of RAM you have. So essentially you can pretend as if you had infinite RAM on your machine. You cannot be limited by what you have. Okay, so this allows any single process to be larger than the size of physical memory. It allows a process to execute even if only portions of it are resident in physical memory and not the whole process. Okay? And it allows you to start a large number of processes such that the total cumulative requirement vastly exceeds the size of RAM. Okay? So you can have more processes fit in memory than you can run concurrently. Okay, I think I have shown this before. Let me just show you one more time. So this is virtual memory. So here the two columns of interest are this one and this one. Okay, so this shows you the amount of virtual memory that has been allocated to each process. This tells you how much of that is actually stored in RAM. Okay, so here you have some process. Yes, it's Java tends to use a lot. So there is Java up there. So it is 500 megabytes of virtual memory, only 228 MB are actually stored in RAM. The rest is on disk. Okay, and you probably have some processes that actually solved this. So you will see that there are many processes that are fairly large in size. Okay, and some of them only are very small. So here is a process that has 300 megabytes. Only 5 megabytes are actually resident in RAM. The rest are all on disk. Okay, so the OS can figure out dynamically how much memory to give to a process and what portions of it to store on disk, which ones to bring in, and so on and so forth. Okay, so it may not be visible, but you can go take a look. Practically every OS will have a utility of this sort. Okay, so if you add up the requirements of all the processes, they will vastly be greater than the RAM you have. Okay, so this is what you get from demand paged virtual memory. So what does this scheme do? Okay, let's say a more formal definition. It essentially uses memory as a cache for disk, or think of it as the other way around. The disk is a backing store for memory. Okay, so if you draw a picture here. Okay, so you typically have your disk, which is the disk on your machine. Okay, part of the disk will actually store your file system, actual files. Okay, so that part does not change here. The file system is still as is, but a portion of the disk is reserved for virtual memory. Okay, in Linux this is called swap space. Okay, so if you know what swap space is, that is basically where memory pages are actually stored on disk. Okay, on Windows sometimes you can actually have a hibernate file. Okay, that's where pages are stored. Okay, memory pages can be swapped out to disk in that hibernate file. Okay, and so on. Okay, I think I don't know what it's called on OS X. But the point being, the disk is actually partitioned into at least two parts. One is where all your regular files are stored, and a portion of the disk is reserved for virtual memory. Okay, virtual memory is basically all the processes that are going to be stored there, and no subset of those processes are here. Okay, so this is RAM. Okay, this is the backing store for RAM. Okay, anything that you cannot store here, you put there. Okay, and then you can bring pieces from here on demand into RAM and take pieces from here and put them on swap space. So you can keep swapping. Yes.
What if you don't have any swap space and like you run a ton of processes?
Okay, so if you don't configure swap space and you run out, you start a number of processes, then the OS will give you an error saying there is no RAM left. Okay, so you could actually start Linux or any OS with zero virtual memory, zero swap space. In that case, your entire process has to fit in RAM at all times. If you start more processes and you run out of RAM, you will get an error. Okay. So demand paging uses memory as a cache for disk. Okay, now what you need to do is the page table needs to keep track of multiple things. Page table needs to figure out, for page table for a process needs to figure out which pages are in memory and which pages are in disk. And not only that, you need to figure out which pages are located in which frame in memory and are in which at which location on the swap space on disk. Okay, so you need additional data structures. Not data structure, but some additional information in the page table to do this. Okay, so that's disk. That's so. Let's say this is an address space of some process. Okay, these are pages of the process. There's a page table here. Okay, the page table essentially say some pages it can point to here, some pages you can say are in disk. So basically for every entry here you have to say is the page in memory or disk, or disk, and if it's in memory, where in memory, if it's on disk, where on disk. Okay. So if some instruction tries to access a page that is not in memory, then the OS will dynamically fetch it from disk to memory. Okay, using a process called page faults. Okay, so I will talk about that in just a second. Okay. So there is an extra bit in the page table that basically tells the OS whether the page is in disk or not. This is basically called the valid bit. The valid bit is set, it says the page is in memory. If it's not set, it tells you that it's on disk. Okay. Now for efficiency reasons, most of the page table accesses have to be to pages that are in memory. If you keep accessing pages that are on disk, your performance is going to be very, very slow. Okay, the reason being the disk is actually a very, very slow version of memory, several orders of magnitude slower. So if you keep accessing pages, if your program keeps accessing pages that are actually stored on disk rather than in RAM, then your performance is going to be really bad. Okay, because you'll have lots of page faults. We'll come back to this. Okay, so for efficiency reasons, you would want the vast majority of memory accesses to go to those pages that are stored in memory. Okay. And the way you do this is by the 90-10 rule, because the 90-10 rule says 90% of the time you are going to access a very small subset of pages, 10% of less or less number of pages. So the basic idea is only keep those pages that are getting access now in memory and the rest can be stored on disk. Okay. So these pages are referred to as the working set of the process. The working set of the process is defined to be the pages that the process is currently working on. Okay, there could be either instructions or data. Okay, those are the pages your program is accessing at this point in time. Okay, over time, as your program executes, the working set will keep changing. Okay, but at any given time, the working set is a small subset of the total number of pages. The basic idea is if you keep those pages in memory, okay, only the working set is kept in memory and the rest is kept on disk, and the performance is still going to be okay because most of the time you will only access the pages that belong to your current working set. Okay, so that's the basic idea. So this is how we get away by storing most of your process address space on disk and yet performance doesn't suffer a whole lot. Okay, otherwise you would have a problem. And the reason you get basically the working set behavior is what is called locality. Okay, so there are two terms here, locality of reference. There's something called a spatial locality, something called a temporal locality. A spatial temporal locality says if an instruction accessed a certain page at this time t, it is very likely to get accessed in the near future. Okay, in time. So if you look at accesses in time, if I access page 1 now, in the near future you're likely to access that page again. This is how programs behave. Okay. Spatial locality basically says if I accessed a certain page I at a certain time, then I am likely to access its near neighboring pages, okay, in the near future. So it's basically saying that you have locality, spatial locality, and then temporal locality says across time there's you keep accessing the same set of pages. Because of this behavior of programs, you basically get this working set which contains all the pages you are actively accessing, and those are the ones you store in memory. So this is the same picture I drew there. Okay, so this is your virtual memory. Okay, that's the virtual address space of a process. It is actually segmented paging. I didn't show the segments here for simplicity, so we'll just ignore segments, but there are segments and segments are paged. Okay, so we'll ignore the segments for now. Okay, so we'll just assume that they are just a sequence of pages. Okay, so for all of these pages you maintain a page table. The page table basically has a valid bit and it has entries. Okay, the valid bit says, is this page either in memory or is it on disk, is it on swap space. Okay, and then the entry tells you where is it stored. Okay, the arrows essentially tell you that that page there is stored in this frame, and then it shows you that this page is stored at this location on swap space, and so on and so forth. Okay, yes, question.
Why is the disk pointing to the memory? Is that being loaded?
Yes, the disk is pointing to memory, basically saying there are some on-disk data structure that says these pages are also precedent in memory. Okay, so they are actually in both locations. Because once you, if you bring a page from here to here, you don't delete it from the disk. Okay, so this just says that that page is already loaded, just in case you look at the disk as well. Okay. So now we sort of look at the important questions of which pages are stored in memory and when do you decide, okay, where to put these pages. Okay, the simplest thing is when to load a page in memory is you do this at process start time. All the pages of the address space are loaded into RAM when the process starts. Okay, this is the simplest thing you can do. Okay, in this case, you really don't have any demand paging. The whole process is resident in RAM at all times. Okay? So here the OS does not have to make any decision of when to load a page. Whenever you start a new process, you take all of its pages and you put them in RAM. Okay, this is what we have been assuming until the previous class. The whole process is resident. Okay, but it doesn't allow us to do all these nice things of providing an illusion of infinite memory and so on. Okay, but the OS decision is very simple. It doesn't have to deal with which pages to store and where. Okay, so that's one. The second thing is the programmer tells the OS which pages to keep in memory and which one to keep on disk. Okay, so this thing saying these two pages are in memory and this one and the rest are stored on disk, this is actually given to the OS by the programmer. Okay, so there is a technique called overlays that actually preceded virtual memory. Okay, now the OS does all of this for you, but before virtual memories were actually put in the OS kernel, this is sort of pre Windows NT days, Windows 3, DOS, early versions of Mac OS X didn't have virtual memory. The only way you could actually have programs that exceeded the size of RAM or programs that made efficient use of RAM where the application programmer decides which part of the process to bring. So what the application programmer might do is he might chop the address space into smaller pieces and issue explicit commands saying go load the next piece and throw the previous piece out. Okay, so the programmer is doing this, okay, just to make efficient use of memory. Okay, today you don't even think of such things. Okay, so you don't actually do any explicit memory management. The OS is deciding everything for you. But there was a time where if you wanted to make efficient use of your 600 kilobytes of memory you have on your machine, then you better do your own memory management. If you put everything in memory, you are going to run out very quickly. Okay. So those are called overlays. Okay, so again, old technique, not used anymore. But OS doesn't have to do anything. The programmer tells the OS what to do. The first case, the whole process is in memory. The second case, the programmer tells you. Okay, so request paging is a slight extension of this, where the process can monitor itself and tell the OS which pages to load. Because typically, most processes don't have that intelligence. They cannot tell the OS what to do, but there is a scheme called request paging where the process provides an information in time to load this page or not. Okay. So now what we have in modern operating system is what is called demand paging, where the OS monitors the behavior of a process, its page access patterns, and it decides which page to keep in memory and which one not to. Okay, so the simplest thing in demand paging is load the page the first time it is accessed. Okay, so initially when a process starts up, when you start up a new process, you don't load any except for the first page. Okay, load the first code page and leave the rest on swap space. Okay, don't even load it. Okay. Now as you execute instructions, this program will start accessing some memory pages. The first time you access some page, you basically go and bring, fetch it from disk and stick it in RAM. Okay. So you bring pages from disk into RAM purely on demand, as and when assembly instructions of your process actually access that page in some shape or form. Okay. So you bring a page into memory whenever it's referenced. When you bring a page, you might have to evict some page. Okay, so if your RAM is full of active pages, whenever you bring a page from here to here, you might have to throw one out. Okay, because there may not be any free space in memory. So that's something to keep in mind, and we'll see how to do that. Okay, so whenever you bring one, you might have to evict one. And the process of fetching a page from disk and putting it into RAM and evicting some existing page is referred to as a page fault. Okay, yes, you have a question.
Wouldn't the process always have to have at least one page in the memory?
Yes, process will at least have to have one, but typically it may have several hundred, yes. But what I'm saying is if there isn't any free frames available, you bring a page from disk, you might have to make room for that page by throwing out an existing page and then put that page in that location.
So it's unlikely that you'll have so many processes that it'll there won't be enough room for pages of those processes?
Yes, typically the RAM will get filled up quickly. And then when you start bringing new pages, you have to start evicting.
Hence, that each process needs to have at least one page in the memory. If it's not in the running state, couldn't it?
If the process is not even running, everything can get swapped out.
Okay.
If it is doing some very long I/O where there's nothing happening, you could certainly swap it out.
Okay.
Okay, but typically, I think the way most OSs work, if you have enough room for tens or hundreds of pages per process. You don't have millions of processes running on a machine, so that you can only allocate one page per process. If you have hundreds, there is room for everyone to have some tens or hundreds of pages. Okay. But coming back to page fault, so page fault is basically essentially an interrupt that occurs when your instruction accesses a page that is not in memory. Okay, so going back to the picture here, so this is a page that's actually stored on disk. Okay, suppose there's an instruction that you are executing that accesses that page. So you do a page table lookup. A page table lookup basically will tell you the valid bit is not set. Okay, so it's an invalid access because that page is not in memory. Okay, this will trigger a hardware level interrupt. Yes, and the interrupt will cause you to go to the OS kernel and say this process is trying to access that page. It's not in memory. Go fetch it. Okay, then the OS will go off and try to fetch this page, and it will basically, this is now a disk read. Okay, so you are going to read this page from disk, bring it into memory. Optionally, if there isn't any space here, you might have to first write out a page and make space. Okay, take a page and put it back on disk, bring that requested page in. Once that requested page arrives in memory, the process is restarted. Okay, because it was basically trying to access that page, generated this interrupt. So it is going to be sitting on the wait queue, waiting for the page to arrive. Once the page is arrived, it's going to be restarted. Okay, you re-execute that instruction, and at this point, now the instruction will succeed. Okay, that's questions. Yes.
So when you get the interrupt, you said it goes into waiting. Does that mean other processes can run while it accesses the memory?
Yes, other processes can run because page fault is a form of I/O. It's an implicit, the process is not doing explicit I/O, but portions of the process were swapped out, so now you are fetching it. Process triggered I/O. If the process is doing I/O, something else can run.
So will it be put at like the front of the queue, or is it just automatic push to the front of the I/O?
When it's done, you can actually restart the process, because you basically took its time slice away for no fault of its own. It was the OS's decision not to have that page. So you can just restart that instruction. Okay, so you can, yes.
So couldn't you get into a deadlock situation where you're trying to, you know, one process says I need these, you know, this page. Another process says it stops, you know, tries to fetch it, stops running. Next process starts running. It needs a page. But the page comes in and overwrites the one that the first one was looking for. that guy is now trying to get it again as a second problem, especially hit it again.
Okay. So question is, can you not have a scenario where process one tries to read a page from disk, okay, while it's fetching? Process two also generates a page call, fetches a page from disk, etc., etc. This scenario has is given a special name. Okay, it's called thrashing. Okay, if you heard of this term, it's basically when there's excessive paging activity. Okay, it's not a deadlock per se, but there's a lot of paging activity that practically you try to execute one instruction, it generates a page fault and the process suspended, you try to fetch that. And when the page comes in, you try to execute the next instruction and another page fault. Like frequent page faulting is referred to, that scenario is referred to as thrashing. This typically occurs because you have overcommitted memory. You started way too many processes, that there isn't any enough room to keep the working set. But the reason you are thrashing is if you don't have room to even keep the working set, you are going to thrash a lot. Because the working set is the set of pages you are working on, you better have enough space to keep that. If you start too many processes, then the amount of RAM you can commit to any one will shrink below the working set. And at that point, you will thrash. Okay, the performance will actually plummet. You will not see any interesting thing happening other than a lot of disk will keep spinning. Okay, so you can have this kind of thing when you run large Java processes. You hear your disk spinning a lot and you are not doing any explicit I.O. It may be that your machine is thrashing. It's constantly fetching pages from disk into memory and then evicting some page, and that page gets accessed. You fetch it back and you're just doing a lot of wasted work. Okay, so that's a scenario you want to avoid. Either reduce the number of processes or buy more RAM. There's only two ways you can fix it. Right. Okay, so coming back, so page fault is a slow operation, okay, because it involves disk I/O. So typically you want to avoid it. So to avoid it, you want to keep at least the working set, if not more pages in memory. Okay. But nevertheless, it should be clear how page faults occur. They occur when you have an instruction that accesses a page that's stored on disk, not in RAM. Okay, that generates a trap because it's as far as the OS is concerned, it's an invalid page table access because that page is not in memory. So the OS has to then go fetch the page, put it in memory, update the page table entry, at which point the instruction can execute. Yes, question.
Is the entire kernel loaded into RAM, or is that also accessed from disk?
Okay, so question is the entire kernel loaded in RAM, or the kernel also paged? Right? So typically, if the kernel is small, you have enough memory for the kernel. You can actually not page the kernel for performance reasons. Okay, but there have been some kernels that also get paged. Monolithic kernels is a good example. Microkernels are a good example. In microkernels, anything that's not part of the microkernel is also paged, even though that may be an OS component. So it is treated like a user process. So for performance reasons, kernel memory is what is called hardwired or sort of locked. You don't actually page that memory. You just keep it all in memory, in RAM. Okay, but user processes can be paged. Okay. So that's demand paging. Now to improve performance, the OS can make educated guesses about what pages a process can access in the near future and actually trigger I/O to fetch that page even before the page is accessed by the process. This is called pre-paging. So you pre-fetch pages before they are accessed and avoid the performance penalty of a page fault. Okay, so if you can guess what pages this process is going to access in the near future and say of those pages, this page A, C and E are not yet in RAM, and you can trigger I/O request to fetch them before even the process accesses it, then you basically improve performance. Okay, so if you make good guesses, performance improves. Right? If you make bad guesses, you've just done wasted work, fetch some pages that the process does not care about. Okay, so the performance improvement very much depends on how accurately the OS can guess what any given process is going to do and prefetch pages that are not yet in memory. Yes, question.
Doesn't Windows take processes like the first time you run them and just like dump most of their memory into things like a prefetch file?
Yes. So you're asking how Windows, I don't know exactly what Windows does, but many operating systems actually keep track of process behavior the first time you run it. So subsequently when you run the same process again, maybe it's Word or Firefox, there's some information about how this process behaved previously. you can use this information to pre-page, because you can't really know what the process is going to execute. But if you have some history from previous runs of this process, you can make better guesses. Okay? But can always go wrong, because if you take a branch in the code and do something, do the else part instead of the if part, and you fetched all the pages of the if part, then you made the wrong guess. Okay? So you can never completely do this right, but you can make good guesses many times. Okay? So some OSs do this, not all. Most OSs can just do that and still be okay. Okay, some OSs try to go one step further and do pre-paging. Yes, yes, question.
You say preloads into memory, is that like when you run the process, it loads a specific
no.
set?
No, so as it is executing, you say in the near future, so maybe you have executed for 5 minutes, and then you say in the near future, what is this process likely to do? Okay, so and then of those pages, what do I have in RAM and what's not in RAM, what's on disk? So let's go and fetch the ones that are not in disk. So this is how you guess. And you keep doing this every so often or every process. That's called pre-page. Not at startup time. This happens throughout the execution of a process. Okay, so here is a sort of a big, long list of steps that the OS has to go through to implement demand paging. Okay. So demand paging essentially assumes always that the entire address space is always stored on disk. Okay, so we'll assume that a copy of the whole address with all the pages of a process always available on disk. Okay. And some subset will be in RAM. And the valid bit in the page table tells us which pages are in RAM and which ones are not in RAM. So one says in memory, zero says not. Okay, if the page is not in memory, that's a page fault. If you access a page not in RAM, it's a page fault that causes a trap. And these are all the instructions, not the instructions, the steps that this trap handler has to execute. Page fault routine. Select a page to replace. If there isn't enough room, before you fetch the page, you must evict something and make room. This technique is called page replacement, and we'll look at several page replacement algorithms in a couple of slides. Okay, first step, decide which page goes out to make room for the incoming page. Okay, so then you invalidate the entry for the page that you are throwing out in the page table, because now it's going to go back on disk, it will no longer be in RAM. Then you start loading this new page from disk to RAM. Okay. And then at this point, this is I/O, you basically switch to some other processes and these processes run. At some point in time, the I/O has finished, the page has actually arrived in memory. At that point, the OS will get an interrupt and it will basically update the page table and restart the process. Okay, update the page table entry and it will continue the faulting process. Okay. And there's a question here saying, why not continue the current process? There was a question that was asked there. Because this process was kicked off the run queue or from the run state for no fault of its own. This was OS's decision not to have that page in memory. You basically give priority to this process instead of resuming the process that's now running. Okay, because that page fault has been serviced at this point. Yes, question.
It seems like there's a lot of stuff going on, like before anything is even loaded into memory. How did, like, isn't that going to be really slow, like considerably slow?
Lot of stuff in terms of starting a process up.
Well, and also like when running the process, it's like checking and like determining what to get rid of. And
yes. So clearly, page fault is not a fast process. It's going to take you tens of milliseconds to execute. Yeah, because you have to check what to throw out. Should you throw out a page of this process? Should you penalize some other process and throw its page out? All of these decisions have to be made. And it has an impact on performance also. Okay, so this, but the good news is page faults don't actually occur very frequently. If you have enough memory and the OS has done its job, kept the working set of each process, page faults are relatively rare. Okay, so if you actually go and execute this command vmstat on a Linux machine, it will show you the paging activity of that process. I don't think it works. Let me check whether it works on. I don't think there's vmstat here. I don't think it is there here as well. Disk activity. Let's see. That doesn't tell us whether the disk is paging or is it just actual reads and writes. But on Linux machines, if you do vmstat, you will actually see how much paging activity is happening. And you'll see that if the memory is used well, there's very little paging. So this doesn't happen frequently. Okay, it looks like a long list of things to do, but you only pay this price once in a while. Yeah, as the working set changes. Okay, yes, question.
So the reason that doesn't happen often is that because we have good page replacement algorithms?
Because you have good locality. 90-10 rule says once you have this 10% that this process is working on in memory, then it will keep working on that for a while. So you don't need to have any more paging. Then eventually the working set will change because you basically exited from a function and now the program is accessing some other function that has a different working set. And you will get a whole sequence of page faults and fetch the new working set. And then you will keep going for a while and so on and so forth. So the locality is not the page replacement. The page replacement also helps. If you throw out a page that is no longer in the working set by making a good guess, and we'll see how to do that, then you don't actually do anything, any wasted work. But this is what actually makes it very infrequent. So if you didn't have this, if page accesses were random, then you would be in a lot of trouble because you don't know which page to throw out and which pages to keep because they are all randomly chosen by the process. Thankfully, the access patterns are not random. They exhibit locality. They're saying that you access only a small subset of pages and keep accessing them frequently. Okay, so that is your demand paging. Okay, swap space is what I just mentioned. That's the region on disk where all the memory address space, rather the virtual addresses or virtual pages are kept. Okay. Now, there is an optimization you can do as far as swap space is concerned. Okay, and then optimization says that as far as the code segment of that process is concerned, don't keep those pages on swap space. Just basically use the program itself as the backing store. The file system can be the backing store. So here is basically a picture that might make this clear. Okay, so let's say this is Firefox. Okay. Assume there are two segments. There's a data segment, code segment. Okay, each is page. Okay. That is your swap space. That's the file system. This is swap. Okay. First rule is everything that is contained within this address space of the process needs to be on disk. Always. Okay. So all of these data pages will have a corresponding copy on disk, okay, each of these. Okay. And then the naive thing to do is take each of the code pages and also keep a copy on the swap space. And then we have just satisfied our requirement that every page of this process will always have a copy on disk and only some subsets will be resident in RAM. Okay. Now an optimization to this mechanism is don't keep the code pages on the swap space. The code pages already exist on the file system. Okay, because the Firefox .exe or the binary, okay, is essentially the data that's contained in the code page. Okay, because that's the program that you load and you allocate some memory for storing the heap and the stack and whatnot. So the code is already on disk on your file system. So you will actually use this file, the Firefox, whatever, the binary file, to be the backing store for the code pages. Okay, so if you actually access a code page that's not stored, you'll go to the binary and actually bring that region in to RAM rather than keeping a copy of these code pages on swap space. This is just an optimization. You don't have to do this. Okay, you could have just as well taken the code pages and also put them on swap, but you are wasting disk space because there's a copy of all of those pages in the binary. Okay, because there's the same code in both places. Okay. So basically it says if the page contained code, you basically can keep a copy of it in the file system and not keep a separate copy. Okay. That's the first thing to keep in mind. Now let's look at what happens when a page is removed from memory. Okay. So whenever you evict a page from memory, you have to decide whether to write it back to disk or not. Okay. So we'll always assume that a copy of the page is stored on disk. Okay. Now after you fetch the copy from disk into RAM, if you updated the copy in RAM, because let's say you updated the value of a variable, you just said I equal to 5. This basically goes towards the value 5 in the corresponding region of RAM where the variable I is stored. So that page has been written to, it's been updated. The copy in RAM is newer than the copy on disk. Okay, so now the two copies are different. So if that page gets evicted, because of page replacement, and you have to take this copy and you have to write it back, overwrite the old page so that the newer version is now back on disk. Okay? So whenever you evict, if the page is returned to, which and the term for the an updated page is, we call it a dirty page. The page has been dirtied, you have to write it to disk. If the page has not been dirtied, which means it was not modified since it was fetched from disk, then you don't need to write it back to disk, you can just overwrite the contents. Because the copy on disk is still current, so you can always fetch it back. Okay, so if you have a newer version in memory, write it back. The version on disk is the same as the version in memory, you just overwrite. Okay, so that's what this thing says. If the page contained code, code pages typically don't change. Okay, because code you don't change, only the data pages change, you can simply remove it. If the page contained data, then if it's been updated, you save it, otherwise you can just overwrite it. Okay. So what this is saying is, at any time a page within a process can be in physical memory, it can be on swap space, or if it's and if it's a code page, then it can also be on the file system. Okay, because the code pages, you basically use the file itself as the backing store for the code segment. Okay, so a page can be at any of these locations at any given time. And the page table needs to now track where each page is up, not just where in RAM, but where is it on disk as well. So page table becomes more complicated to implement demand paging. Questions on this? Is that clear? Okay. So now let's talk about performance. Okay, so here is where I think this locality of reference comes to our rescue. So basically, if your page accesses were random, every instruction could access a random page, it could trigger a page fault. Fortunately, programs exhibit localities of reference. They access things, the same page over and over again, or a set of nearby pages. Okay, so temporal locality says, if a process accesses a memory item, then it will access the same memory item again. Okay, if you are currently accessing variable I, you might be accessing that in your if or a for, you will keep accessing this for some time. Okay. That's what results in temporal locality. Okay. Spatial locality says, if you access a memory item I, you might access an adjacent item soon. Example of this is arrays. If you are accessing A of I, okay, ith element of an array, it's very likely that whatever you are doing, you might access I plus 1 or I minus 1 or some nearby element, because you may be in a loop or you may be doing something. Okay. That kind of behavior results in spatial locality. Okay, so locality in time and locality in space. Okay. So because of this, if you keep the working set, you are going to be in good shape. Okay, so now here is a small equation that shows you what the memory performance is. Just as we had seen what kind of speed up you get from keeping a TLB, this equation analyzes what kinds of slowdown you get because of page faults. Okay, page faults are going to slow your process down. Okay. So effective memory access time when you have demand paging is the probability of a page fault, okay, times the page fault access time. Okay, and then you plus 1 minus p, which is the probability that it was not a page fault, the page is in memory, times memory access. Okay. The more accurate term is not that, but you have to take into account TLB and whatnot. Okay, so it's actually 1 minus p times. Okay, that's what we did last time. Okay, it's actually that. But we ignore the disk accesses are so much slower that we just ignore all of this. This is a simplified version. That equation there is a simplified version of the actual expression. Okay. Yes?
Do we need to do a memory access to see if it's on disk or it?
Or you need to look up the page table entry. Yeah. The page table entry is in the TLB, you don't look up the memory. But if you get a TLB miss, you will first go to the page table in memory and look it up. And it may still be a page fault because the page table might indicate. So you might get a TLB plus MA plus page fault. Okay. All of those things may happen. So this equation is a lot more messy. This is a simplified version. And we'll go with that. We'll not look at all the TLBs and all of those things in the context of this, just to make the point. Okay, so now it says if memory access time is 200 nanoseconds and a page fault takes 25 milliseconds, that's 6 orders of magnitude difference. Okay. So his memory is 6 orders of virtual memory, or rather demand page virtual memory is 6 orders of magnitude slower than real memory. So you don't want this case to happen frequently at all, otherwise you'll get very bad performance. So it says what, so you can plug in MA is 200 nanosecond, page fault time is 25 milliseconds. Okay, then it basically says if you want the effective access time to be only 10% slower, if you want the performance due to demand paging, okay, to be overall only 10% slower, what should be the value of P? Okay, so the way you would solve this, okay, if you want memory access time is 200 nanoseconds. It is 5 orders, yes. Okay, so if you want a 10% slowdown, then the right hand side becomes 220. Okay, that's the effective memory access time is 220. Yes. Okay, so that's what you plug in. So this is 220, this is this. So you basically get 20. Okay, so essentially this is 1 minus this, which is 0.00005 and 1. Okay, so the probability of a page fault is vanishingly small. Okay, 1 in a million instructions or 10 million instructions should access result in a page fault. If you have any more frequent page fault, then your slowdown is going to be even more. So even if you page fault once every million instructions, you see a 10% slowdown. If you fault once every 100,000 instructions, you'll probably see a 50 or 60% slowdown. If you fault any more, then you basically see a dramatic slowdown, almost like you're thrashing. So you want this page fault to occur very rarely, once in several million or once every 10 million instructions. Only then will you see performance that basically is not perceptible. You will not see any significant slowdown. It will be very slight, something you can ignore. So page faults are very slow. The take home is page faults are very slow. You don't want them to occur frequently. Okay? And you get that because you have temporal and spatial locality, and if you keep your working set, you frequently are okay. Okay, so there are all these additional details of updating the TLV. I'm going to go through this quickly, okay, and not belabor the point here. So just as every time there's a page fault, you access the page table, every time there's a page fault, you also have to access the TLB, update the TLB. Okay, so lots of things have to happen. So initially when you do a memory access, you check the TLB entry. Okay, let's assume it's a TLB hit, then you just know where the frame number is, you're done. If it's a TLB miss, okay, then you will go to the page table. Okay? And if the page table indicates it's in pages in memory, then you just update the TLB and you are done. Okay? This is not a page fault, it was just a TLB miss. You just updated the page table. Okay? Next case is a page is not even in memory. Okay? Then basically you will need to do a page fault. Okay? So you will first take a TLB entry, evict it. Okay? And then you basically invalidate the entry, perform the page fault operation, update the page table, update the TLB entry, restart the faulting process. Okay, so, lot of bookkeeping is the short answer. You have to update page tables, update the TLB, find which one to evict. When you evict a page, you have to go and update that processes page table, saying that page is no longer in memory. So, all of these things have to be done. Okay, so, page faults are basically not very fast. So, the one thing I didn't mention is this page fault can result in two disk IOs, not one. If you're evicting a page, it has to first write out an old page and then fetch a new page. That's two IOs. Okay, so you can have some more bigger slowdown than just a single disk IO which reads the page into memory. Yeah, so which means it can be even slower than what is said here. Okay. The good news is all of this is transparent to the process. Process doesn't know this is happening at all. Process is just executing its instructions. In the background, sometimes it gets suspended because it accesses the page that's not in memory. Page gets fetched, it gets restarted. Okay, as if nothing had happened. Okay, but there are some more details that you have to keep in mind. Okay, so this is where things get tricky. Okay, so suppose that a process executed an instruction that triggered a page fault. Okay, so what do we need? We need to somehow require hardware support that saves the faulting instruction, that one triggered the page fault and the CPU state, so that you can restore it after the page fault has been serviced. Okay, but that is not always easy to do. Okay, you can look at this instruction here. Yeah, so this instruction essentially says increment the value in register R10 and move that value into variable A, which is a location in memory. Now if variable A is stored on a page that is on disk, then this instruction is going to trigger a page fault. Okay. So basically what does this instruction do? You increment R10 and you then try to store that value at location at variable A, which is in a certain page, find that the page is not there, triggers the page fault, you go, you get the page, and then you re-execute this instruction. Okay. At the CPU level, there is no concept of executing the remaining half of the instruction. You execute the whole instruction again. Okay. So now you will re-execute this instruction, you will again increment R10 and move that value to A. Okay, this time A is already in a page that's resident in memory, so the instruction will just execute fine. But what has happened is because you did this incrementing the first time around, when you triggered the page fault, you would have incremented this twice instead of once. Okay, this is called as an unwanted side effect. You executed half the instruction and found that before you could actually do the other half, which is move that register value into memory as a page fault. So the hardware, you need hardware support to unwind the side effect. Okay, the only way this works correctly is if this instruction triggers a page fault, you have to decrement R10 again so that you can re-execute this instruction at a later time. Okay, and not have this register value get incremented twice by accident. Okay, so if you wanted this to be really transparent to the user and user programs in particular, you want to make sure that regardless of where the page fault occurs through the execution cycle of a single instruction, you don't want that to have any unwanted effects. Okay. So this is an easy case. Okay. So this one I think you can easily say, fine, just decrement it and re-execute at a later time. That's not a problem. Okay. Here is a more tricky case. Okay. So this is basically a block memory copy instruction. With a single instruction, you can essentially say, take these pages and copy them to these new locations, overwriting the old contents. Okay, so now you can say, you can basically specify a chunk of 10 pages, saying take pages 3 to 13 and copy them to pages, let's say some other, give some different range. So then you take page at a time and keep copying. Okay. Now if you started a copy process, there are 10 pages to copy, you copied 5 of them and overwritten some pages. And now if there is a page fault at the 6th page, because that page was not in memory so you can't overwrite it, then there is no way to unroll this, because you already overwritten some pages, the old value of pages is gone. Yes, you already overwrote the content, so you can't just say, I will uncopy. Okay, once you copy, overwrite it, there is no getting those contents back. Okay. So here you don't want the page fault to occur in the middle of the instruction, because you can't unwind this instruction. This side effect is permanent. Once you overwrite a page in the memory copy or block copy operation, you can't get the old contents back. So the only way around is you have to check that all the pages that this instruction is going to touch are all resident in memory. Only then do you even start the instruction. Okay, so you have to take a page fault even before the instruction starts in this case. Otherwise, this instruction will basically not do what it's supposed to do. Okay. So to get a virtual memory write, you have to ensure that all these details at the instruction level are also taken care of. Yes, you want to make sure that you can unwind side effects or make sure the instruction is going to go through without a page fault. Okay, like in this case. Otherwise, you cannot make it transparent. Okay, any questions on this? Okay. So the last thing we'll talk about briefly is page replacement. Okay, so this is the problem of figuring out which page to evict. Okay, whenever you bring a page, you have to evict some page. So we'll look at what policies allow us to decide which page to evict. We'll look at three policies, and maybe today we'll only do two. We'll leave the third one for next class. Okay, FIFO, first in, first out, we'll look at one called MIN, and then there's one called LRU, or least recently used. This is the policy that is used in most real operating system. It's actually not even this policy, but an approximation of LRU is what is used. So you use an approximation for efficiency reasons, as we'll see next time. Okay? But let's now look at, rather than this wordy slide, let's go into each of these and understand. Okay, first policy is FIFO. FIFO basically says first in, first out. Okay, new page comes in, throw the oldest one out. Okay, that's the page that came first, so you build the one that is oldest, that's the one that goes out. The oldest page goes out, that's first in, first out. So the best illustrated with an example. Okay, three. So assume that RAM has three frames. Okay, you only have three frames in RAM. And you are basically given a process with four pages, A, B, C, and D. Okay? And what you have is called a reference stream, is the order in which those pages are accessed as the process executes. This is exactly how the instructions are accessing these pages. Okay? So now you want to say, if your policy is FIFO, what are the contents of RAM at any given time as each of those pages are accessed? Okay, initially, this is pure demand paging. So we'll start with the empty process. And then we'll start filling RAM and fetch pages from disk. So all those A, B, C, D pages are on disk. Initially, RAM is empty. We are going to execute this request stream and try to see what is stored in each of this frame at every time instant. Okay, and then that will tell you how FIFO works. Okay, is that problem clear? Yes? No? Yes. Okay, so I think I can't write here, so I'm going to write here. So what you will do, you have F1, F2, F3, ABC. Okay, that's your, that's time, okay, that's your reference stream, okay. So first thing that the process does is access page A. So you say, is page A in RAM? The answer is yes, there is nothing to do. If it's not in RAM, that's a page fault. Okay, so you start with an empty slate, there's nothing on the nothing in RAM, so this is going to be a page fault. Okay, so you will go to disk and you'll fetch the page, you'll put it in. At this point, the memory is empty, so you can put it wherever you want. So you're going to put page A in frame 1. And then I'm putting a star saying that access triggered a page fault. Okay. So now A is still in memory then, but the process accesses page B. Okay. That's also a page fault because B is not in RAM. Okay. So you'll go fetch B from disk and we'll now put it. There's nothing to evict because we still have free space yet. Okay. So we'll put B in frame 2. Okay. So at time 2, there are two pages in memory that have arrived, page A and page B. Okay. Then you go access C. Okay, that's another page fault. Okay, so you are going to go fetch C. A and B are still there. Okay, now you put C in frame 3. Okay? So then the process goes accesses page A. Okay? Page A is still in memory. So this is not going to be a page fault. Memory contents will not change. Okay, so at this time step, pages are still A, B, and C. Nothing has changed. Then process accesses B. Okay, B is still in memory. So that's not, this access is not a page fault either. So you basically have A, B, C. Okay. Then process accesses D. Okay, that's a page fault. Okay. Now this is where page replacement is going to kick in. Your frames are all filled up, so you have to throw out a page to make room for D. Okay. And depending on the policy, you might choose a different frame. First in, first out says that the page that came in first of this set needs to be thrown out. That's the oldest page. Okay, so which page came in first? It was A. Yet A is the oldest of the three because A was fetched here, B was fetched here, C was fetched here. The one that's old, this is the oldest one. So we are going to throw D out, A out, and replace it with D. These two are not changed. That's the page code.
Just because A wasn't loaded, doesn't it was accessed two steps ago?
Yes, we are not looking at access pattern. So we are just the access. If you look at access pattern, you get a different policy. The policy you're talking about is what least recently used does. Okay, you will actually look at how pages are used, not when they were brought in. FIFO just says when was the page brought in, throw the oldest one, regardless of how it was accessed. You don't care about how it was accessed. Okay? So then you access A. Okay, so now you just threw out A, so that's the page fault again. So now of D, B and C, you throw the oldest one. Okay? B is the oldest, so that's what you throw out. So you have D, A, C, page fault, you access D again, that's already here, that's not a page fault, so memory content don't change. Then you access B, page fault, so C is the oldest, because that shows the one that you fetched here, then D was fetched here and A was fetched here. So D, A, B, then you access C. It's another page fault because C is not in memory. So D is the oldest one here. And then you access D. That's a page fault also. So you'll throw out A. C, A and B, A is the oldest one. Okay, so you can count in this access stream how many page faults you got. There's 3, 6, 8. So given, so this shows you how the page replacement works. So this was, if this was actual process, that's exactly what the OS would do. At each of those page accesses, it would check the page table. If the page is not in memory, it would pick a page to have it, it would throw that out, fetch a page, replace it, update the page table. So that's, if you use FIFO, that's what your process's memory contents would look like at any given point in time. Okay? So FIFO is very simple. You just look at the oldest page. Okay, this is a more interesting algorithm. Okay, this one says, it's called MIN. It says look into the future and throw out the page that's going to get access farthest into the future. Okay, so same access pattern, but you are not going to look at the oldest page. You're going to look into the future and say which page is going to get access farthest into the future, and that's what we are going to throw out. Okay, so let me give intuition why this makes sense. So why should you throw out the page that gets access farthest into the future?
And you have the most time until you have to do page fault. Right.
So if you want to have as few page faults as possible, if you have three pages and you want to throw one of them out, you say which of these three is going to get access at what point, and the one that is accessed the farthest, you throw that out, so you are deferring that page fault to the longest possible time. Okay, because if you throw any other page, then that page gets accessed before these others, so you sort of have a page fault closer to this current time. Okay, so you want to throw out the page that gets accessed the farthest into the future. Okay, and you can prove, although I'm not going to prove it here, you can prove that this is an optimal policy. You can do no better. Okay, if you wanted to actually minimize faulting activity, this policy, which is called MIN, is the best. Okay, it will basically give you the fewest possible page fault, and no other policy can do better. Okay, yes, question.
Why is it called MIN?
It minimizes the page faults. So you want minimum page faults. Okay. So now that said, this is like a shortest job first situation. Okay. This policy, although it's optimal, you cannot really implement. Yeah, because nobody is going to tell you what's going to happen in the future. OS is not going to be an oracle and say, I know what's going to happen, so I know which page to throw out. Okay? So page, you can only look at the past, what has already happened. You cannot really look at the future. In this example, we know the access stream a priori. You actually know the whole access pattern. Typically, you don't know that. You only know, if this is the current time, you only know what's happened in the past. You don't know what is going to get access in the future. Here we are given this trace, so we can actually simulate how opt or min would have behaved But in reality, you have no knowledge of the future. So you cannot actually implement this policy in any real operating system. It's the best policy to implement, but also infeasible to implement. Okay, just like we did shortest job first, saying great policy cannot do it. Yes, same problem. So we have run out of time, so I'm not going to do this exercise. We'll revisit it next time. We'll work through it and we'll see, keep that number 8 in mind. We'll work through it and see how many page faults we get here. Okay, it should be lower than that number. Okay, stop here.